Taking off his crown and binding his hair properly, Jarasandha stood up like an ocean bursting its continents. Then the monarch, possessed of terrible prowess, addressing Bhima, said, "I will fight with thee. It is better to be vanquished by a superior person." Saying this, Jarasandha, that repressor of all foes, endued, rushed with great energy at Bhimasena, like the Asura Vala of old who rushed at the chief of the celestials. The mighty Bhimasena, on whose behalf the gods had been invoked by Krishna, having consulted with that cousin of his, advanced towards Jarasandha, impelled by the desire of fight. Then those tigers among men, those heroes of great prowess, with their bare arms as their only weapons, cheerfully engaged themselves in the encounter, each desirous of vanquishing the other. Seizing each other's arms and twining each other's legs, at times they slapped their armpits, causing the enclosure to tremble at the sound, frequently seizing each other's necks with their hands, dragging and pushing it with violence, each pressed every limb of his body against every limb of the other's. They continued, O exalted one, to slap their armpits at times, sometimes stretching their arms and sometimes drawing them close, then raising them up and dropping them down. They began to seize each other, striking neck against neck, forehead against forehead. They caused fiery sparks to come out like flashes of lightning, and grasping each other in various ways by means of their arms, and kicking each other with such violence as to affect the innermost nerves. They struck at each other's breast with clenched fists. With bare arms as their only weapons, roaring like clouds, they grasped and struck each other like two mad elephants, encountering each other with their trunks. Incensed at each other's blow, they fought on, dragging and pushing each other, fiercely looking at each other like two wrathful lions, each striking every limb of the other with his own, using his arms also, and catching hold of each other's waist. They hurled each other to a distance. Accomplished in wrestling, the two heroes clasping each other with their arms, and each dragging the other unto himself, began to press each other with great violence. So, the wrestling that they're performing, what would we call this now?
Greco-Roman?
That even more, because it includes kicking, punching, everything. In other words, whatever you would call today unarmed, open hand martial arts, all the kicks, punches, at the same time with your jiu-jitsu, all those things like that. Like now, it's the jiu-jitsu is only on the ground, but before, jiu-jitsu was above ground and down. It was anything. You want to say something?
It's called mixed martial arts.
Mixed martial arts. Okay. So it's you know what I'm saying. So it's not wrestling means that they just sit there and wrestle on the ground. This is full on whatever fighting you can do with your hands and your feet, you know, combination of punching, kicking, grappling, or like that. Does that make sense? It's all like that. The heroes then performed those grandest of all feats in wrestling called Prishtabhanga, which consisted in throwing each other with face down towards the earth and maintaining the one knocked down in that position as long as possible. Right, so they throw them down face down and then hold them there with their, you know, by their legs or other things like that. Employing his arms, each also performed the feats called Sampurna Murcha and Purna Kumbha. At times they twisted each other's arms and limbs as if these were vegetable fibers that were to be twisted into cords. Striking each other at times with clenched fists, they pretended to aim at particular limbs while the blows descended upon other parts of the body. It was thus that those heroes fought with each other. The citizens, consisting of thousands of Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, even women and the aged, O tiger among men, came out and gathered there to behold the fight. The crowd became so great that it was one solid mass of humanity with no space between body and body. Right? So in South India they say it's so many people that if you threw sesame seeds in the air, they would not hit the ground. Like that. The sound the wrestlers made by the slapping of their arms, the seizing of each other's necks or bringing down each other down, and the grasping of each other's legs for dashing each other to the ground became so loud that it resembled the roar of thunder or of falling cliffs. Both of them were foremost of mighty men, and both took great delight in such encounter. It means, how strong are they? Yeah, 10,000. So how many people are strong as 10,000 elephants? Five. Who are the five?
Bhima.
Duryodhan.
Dhritarashtra. Kichaka. Jarasandha.
Jarasandha. Okay. So how often do people like this, because some of them are really strong, they like to fight, you know, with strength. You know, weaponry, that's Arjuna, he'll fight with weapons, right, with his bow and arrow. Because it's not strength, it's his lightness of hand, his prowess, his mood of victory that gives him his inspiration. But here it's the physical strength. So like we see Bhima, they're going with the chariots, but sometimes he's so enthusiastic he doesn't bother with the chariot. He just runs in front with his club, right? And he doesn't go to where the Kshatriyas are on chariots, he goes to where the Kshatriyas are on elephants. And then he doesn't even bother with the Kshatriyas, he just goes and starts picking up the elephants, spinning them, throwing them on each other, dragging them around by the tail, you know, doing like that. It's more fun. So we can see is that how often would such an opportunity come that Bhima could wrestle with someone of his own strength, right? Or Jarasandha with his. Therefore, they were taking great delight in it, right? And they're both skilled, so they can use all the techniques, you know, and so they would be very, very inspired, right? You have a body of knowledge. If you can use it, then you're always happy, right? Desirous of vanquishing the other, each was on the alert for taking advantage of the slightest lapse of the other. O monarch, the mighty Bhima and Jarasandha fought terribly in those lists, driving the crowd at times by the motions of their hands like Vritta and Vasava of old. Right? Because their hands would move and everybody just fall back because they think they might get hit or something. But in here, now, what does it take that they're each looking for the slightest lapse of the other? What does that mean?
Focus.
Okay. And another thing?
Sensitive.
Conscious. Right? So that's what Prabhupada says. First you become conscious, then you can do something with it. Right? If you're conscious, you can focus, you can get the work done right. If you're conscious, then you can remember Krishna. Right? So it's very, very important. That's why the Vedic system is set up for being conscious. Right? Because if you're not conscious, human life doesn't function. Does that make sense? Because the skills that human beings endeavor in, to the sophistication that you can develop them, takes great concentration. Even if it's unsophisticated, you know, a lion chasing a deer takes focus, takes concentration. They have to be aware of everything, because deers, they jump in any direction. Right? They're not like other, they just run in a straight line. Deers have this system where they can jump in any direction, right? Because they can run, but then they bounce. And when they bounce, they can turn and bounce off any direction. So that makes it very, very difficult. Right? I've seen in the park here when they used to have before that the antelopes, right, the black buck, they would run, and if they were being chased, because sometimes they'd chase each other, so they would run, and they'd have this move that they would jump up in the air, and they wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't tell where they're going. They would stick all four legs out in four directions. So they'd be flying through the air with all their legs out like this. And then depending upon what the other one behind them was doing, they would have to be aware. Then they would suddenly come down and bounce off in a different direction. So then the other one keeps going or stuff like that. Right? So therefore, a lion catches a deer by being very, very conscious. Does that make sense? So anything you do. So the idea is that's what the training is for, is to make you conscious. Right? You have to become conscious. So the tendency is girls are conscious, but their consciousness is simply self-centered. So they have to learn to apply that in interacting with others, right? Caring for others, working with others, using it instead of on themselves, the sensitivity into something. So therefore, then that cooking, cleaning, all these different things make them very, very aware, right? They're already, it means aware, but of themselves. The boys tend to be not aware of anything except for, you know, who you can wrestle and play with and where's food, right? Other than that, then not a whole lot more, right? You know, there. Does that make sense? Yeah? So therefore, by the performance of all these different work, you have to become conscious. The pot doesn't become clean if it doesn't work. You know, you don't get lunch or it tastes terrible if it's not conscious, right? You have to clean, so you have to be aware of where the dirt is. Does that make sense? So all those different things, then you have to see. So the whole training in the Vedic culture is how to actually become conscious. And from that conscious, then you can be aware of the situation, then you can focus, you know what to be done, then you have, it means you become conscious, you learn what is a skill, you learn what is standards, right? Because when you're conscious, then you know the field, right? You can be aware of the field of activities, no? Then there's has to be a judgment of how you're going to what that field can do. That field could do anything, right? But now, what are your standards? So that you get from your knowledge. So you have the skill, okay, and then you can get a certain thing done. Then you have a skill to get it done. Does that make sense? So between your consciousness, then your knowledge of the standards, you know, of human action, then knowledge of the skill of performing those human action, then that consciousness being applied on that, then there's focus. You know what the result can be done from your knowledge, right? You know how to apply it because of your skill. Then you get your result. Does that make sense? So that's basically speaking, you know, all, means all other visions put aside, that's what you're doing here in the school. Does that make sense? That's what you're here for, right? Then with that, then the specific knowledges and other activities necessary for human existence that you're learning. But the main thing is getting that those things, right? Consciousness, standards, and knowledge and skills of the field. Understand? Because if you have that, you will be able to function anywhere. This is a very, very little known or understood principle of the Vedic education. You have that, you're successful in anything. It doesn't matter if it's managing, it's business, administration, any of the educational or fields, any art, it's the same thing. If you aren't conscious of the field, you don't know what the field is, you don't know what you can do with it, and you don't know what you should be doing with it, you won't get anything done. Right? So there's people that are conscious, know the field, what they can do with it, but they don't know what they should be doing with it. Right? Therefore, the modern society for certain people, develops very well. They get many, many things done. They do wonderful things. But it's not necessarily that wonderful thing they did is what they should be doing as a person. Does that make sense? Right? Right? Does that make sense? Right? It's no need. Why do they have to make an atomic bomb? Right? That's great use of intelligence, and endeavor, focus. Now, that was a lot of work to do that. Right? If everybody's sitting around with swords, what do you need a bomb for? It works. It's good enough. Does that make sense? The whole idea is to kill the other person. So there's, you know, it's not to kill the other person and make the place that you just triumphed over unlivable for 10,000 years. You know, that's not the point. You know what I'm saying? Okay? So does that make sense? So consciousness is the first thing. Then you have to know the field and the standards by which you're going to judge what you do with that field. Right? So that's why the Vedic gives standards. That's why it gives direction in this way. Because otherwise, how do you know the result that you're going to endeavor for, that it will give you a human result? And if it's not human, how will you be satisfied? Right? If you're a dog, that you'll do it automatically, right? Super soul will tell you what to do, what to growl at, what to sniff at, you know? Does that make sense? But human, you have to be taught to be human. Because it's a choice, right? To be a dog, that's not a choice. It means you had the choice, you do something that makes you take birth as a dog. That's there, okay? But once you are one, you don't have a choice. Does that make sense? But as a human, you have choice. And so that's what the whole point. Do you choose Krishna or do you not? If you don't, then hey, we got plenty of space here. There's lots of trees here. There's lots of ground to dig holes in. There's lots of air to fly through, you know. And we're in Bengal, plenty of water to swim in. You know, so I'm saying there's tons of opportunity as an animal. That's not the problem. The problem is it's humans that are conscious. From that conscious, they follow Vedic standards. From that, then they have Vedic skills that they apply to get their results, right? Because Veda means knowledge, it's applicable anywhere. You know what I'm saying? Because for the Vedic knowledge is not a body of skills, right? Right? Knowledge, skills, values, right? Heard that before? Right down. That's the opening first day in, you know, most seminars these days. Right? But the point is it's true. But what is that knowledge? If that knowledge is not connected to Krishna, is it knowledge? No, it's illusion. There may be some useful illusion, but it's illusion. And it will keep you in illusion. And unless you give that result to Krishna, but are you that conscious? Right? You can say, yes, I'll give it to Krishna, but where's the training that you do give it to Krishna? Because that seminar will not teach you that. Not at all. They'll give you a body of knowledge, kick you out on the street, then you have to work it out yourself. Right? And it's much harder to work it out when you're doing it rather than before, when you're in an environment which you could learn from, make mistakes, and be corrected. Here it's like you make a mistake, then, you know, material energy deals with you. Right? The society deals with you. Not a teacher. Does that make sense? Right? Skill, what is that skill? What is it going to get you? Right? Is the skill useful for you as a living entity? Is it useful for the society? Is it, can you connect it to Krishna? Right? So the whole thing is the Vedic starts with the values. Understanding that value, then we hear what is the knowledge and the standards. Right? Right? So without that value, without that standards of how it works, why it works, its connection to Krishna, how are you going to understand properly the knowledge and the skill you're going to get from the field? Understand? This is very different. Different from, means we're talking with a group of persons that they themselves are from the modern academy. I was explaining this. And they were saying, this is very, very interesting. He says, this is the opposite of the modern academy. They themselves could see the use of it and see how they were doing it backwards from this. You know, they weren't saying what they were doing was wrong. They were just saying, this sounds very practical, what we're doing. Does that make sense? So that's the difference of the Vedic. Means you know what it is you're trying to get, then everything else comes into perspective. Right? If you're trying to develop love for Krishna, then how are you going to look at the field of activities, the soul and the material energy? Right? You have to look at it, how it's going to, what's its relationship with developing love for God? Right? Then we can look at the field and go, therefore, you are the soul, you are servant of Krishna, material energy is Krishna's inferior energy, it's to be used in his service. Does that make sense? So every body of knowledge in the Vedic starts like that. Right? That's why every shastra starts, the invocation and the first chapter is always on creation, because it starts with God. Modern academics think that's interpolation. Why does all these things have this creation? Why is that necessary? That was put in later, because it's not actually the body of science. So that means they don't actually know what knowledge is. Right? They know what skills are, and some, you know, factual mathematical knowledge, you know, that it's, you know, this is this, okay, this is a column, it's the bricks are kind of reddish with some white in it, and there's a, okay, 15 inches by 20 inches, that they can tell you. But, you know, what's the purpose of building? What's the purpose of architecture? That they can't tell you. Right? Make something to live in. Well, what's life? Oh, well, I'm an architect, so I'm not a philosopher. Then, Vedic culture, everyone's a philosopher. Right? I can go to Calcutta to the Muslim musicians, right? Top ones in India, and ask them about music, right? And raga and that, and what it is. And they're going to start off with Shiva and Parvati. Right? That's where they're going to start. That the ragas are the moods between them and the shared thing. That's where they're going to start. Right. But you go to a Western musician, he may be a fabulous musician. What is music? Well, it's an expression of your feelings, so it starts with you. You understand the difference? Right. An architect in the West, so what is it? Okay, you know, you give me the brief. Okay, what is it that you want? You know, what are you trying to do here? Okay, you have that house. So something like that. But the thing is, they don't know what is a human, what is that? So what is the standards by which they should be living that they decide that they need what they need? Right? Does that make sense? Okay. You're all living here. How many here have, that means, without building it themselves, have two bathrooms in their house? Okay. Okay. So some of you do. Okay. So now, but so many don't. Why? Because in the West, bathrooms aren't that important. Right? Because why? They take bath once a week. They don't get up at Mangal Artik everyone at the same time and everyone's in the bathroom. How many of you are late for programs because, you know, there's not enough bathroom space in your house? Okay. So now, if that was a value of the architects who built this place, and we built it, why aren't there more bathrooms? Right? How many ladies here are comfortable in, you know, your husband's friends coming over and using your bathroom? How many are comfortable? One. How many are not so comfortable, are not comfortable, yeah, because you have so many things in there, and then every time you have to clean it up, do a mild cleaning, just because he invited someone over. So wouldn't it be nicer if there were two bathrooms, it was a guest bathroom, that you can use anyway, but you don't have to keep all the little bottles in there, right? They go in your bathroom, right? Is there one architect that's built this that ever thought that? No, because they don't know what is human life. They don't know what is the nature of man and woman. They don't know what is guest. They don't know what's the relationship. Therefore, these buildings. Right? Think about it. Are they designing it for how you live? Or is it designed for, you know, North European, you know, weather? Right? Little dinky windows. You see what the British were in India, right? And even their buildings. What do the windows look like? Yeah, yeah. Roof to floor. Not only that, how high is the ceiling? The British buildings are 22-foot ceilings. Right? The reason we have 11-foot is because then they divide it in half and you make... Right? And where, and above those windows and doors that open, what's above them? Ventilators. Right? All louvers and everything. This is what you design here, not some little dinky window with a pitched roof. That's for North Europe. Right? And who designed those buildings? People from North Europe. You understand? So the whole thing is, the Vedic means you start with what are the standards of human life. Then you go down to apply that to the need of the individual. Then you get something that's perfect for you. Right? Does that make sense? You know, otherwise devotees have to take what they have and completely rearrange it. Totally. You know, just gut the house, you know, move everything around, you know, put the, you know, how you say, put the kitchen where the bathroom was, and the bathroom, you know, then where the bedroom, like this, until they get it right. Then it works as a house for them. Does that make sense? So just taking this one thing, we see the total difference in approach. The total difference in approach. So that's just a practical point. So if you understand this, it's in other words, all there is God, the living entity, and the material energy. Everything else is a detail of that. So you understand these three. Technically, you have the facility to understand and work in any body of knowledge. Right? That's why the same education, the same activities have been done for millions of years by everybody who was growing up in the Vedic system. It didn't matter what they were. Right? You're going to be a big businessman. Great, go to Gurukul. Right? You're going to be an administrator of the country. Great, go to Gurukul. Right? You're going to be a big, big pandit, Brahmin, or, you know, like that. Great, go to Gurukul. Does that make sense? So the same thing goes, why? Because it's working with the underlying principle that makes, you know, knowledge and activities work. Right? And that's consciousness. So for us, consciousness is to be used to go back to Godhead, but since we're here in the world, we have to perform our Krishna consciousness through some activity, therefore we're conscious of those activities also. Right? So we're aware of the spiritual, we're aware of the material. Right? Vidyam cha, right? One who knows both, but it's not that he knows this and he knows that, he knows them together. It means he knows God and he knows the material energy that's come from God. So knowing them in connection, then it's not two different lives. You don't live in a life of duality. Right? Think about how many devotees, their lifestyle is dualistic. Because how they have to live on one hand, it doesn't match how their consciousness. Not because they can't do it. They haven't done it. Other than the result, the money is there, but then, okay, the result is there at the end of the week, right? So 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, how many hours is that? 40 hours. And then you're going to take that money and then, okay, we'll put it here, 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 here. And then it's done. How long did it take to go here, 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 here? 5 minutes, maybe an hour if there's more deliberation because there's some priorities. So that means 40 hours, you actually got 1 hour at best of consciousness that was connected to Krishna. So in other words, this science is how all those 40 hours can be connected to Krishna. Right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's the idea. Does that make sense? Yeah. Like that. So never doubt the system. Like that, because it's completely different. It means others will doubt it because they don't know that what we're talking about exists. Right? Because if someone says, oh, are you getting this or that or so many things, just say, okay, nice. You want to have this discussion? What is the purpose of that? You got to get money. Okay, so what do you need money for? Well, you got to take care of it. You got to be practical. Okay, so then right now what you've described is animal existence. That I got money to maintain and feed my family. Okay, great. Now what? You know, and then, you know, then we chant, we do this, that. Well, where's the connection? You understand? So what's being professed is a dual lifestyle. And from what I see and observe and look at it, not very many are surviving it. Right? So at some point they got to dull down their consciousness, so that they can handle this dualistic mentality. So they just go into this very pleasant, as long as nobody rocks the boat, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, and we're like that. Right? Does that make sense? This is where it's coming from. We're conscious, then it all becomes connected to Krishna. Right? Then it doesn't matter what occupation, what this, that you're doing, it's fine. You're connecting it. Does that make sense? Right. So this, yes.
For someone who is not of the higher three Vedas, without the Gurukul training, how do they develop the focus to be able to learn an art that maybe is...
How do they develop the focus? Because they're working under those who have gone to Gurukul. So, and if there is any science behind it, generally they'll learn that from the Gurukul. Right? They'll come as day students like the afternoon. Because in the morning is, you know, you see, the laborers, they always work in the morning. So then after lunch in the afternoon times, that's when they would come to the Gurukul, when the classes aren't technically happening in the Gurukul. And then they would study, you know, the science of their music or architecture or whatever it is like that. If the teacher they're learning from knows it, then they can learn it there. If not, they would learn the skill from the artist and learn the science from the Gurukul. But if the teacher knew both, then great, then it makes it easier. But, you know, but also it'd be, how do they start? If you also think of, it means much of the time it's even still a bit like that. Even the modern skills, how do you start? Right, you want to do carpentry, where do you start? Yeah, but and that apprenticeship, what's your first job? Generally sweeping and cleaning, right? So that way you become aware of what's going on in the field. Otherwise you just come in and you think you're the big guy. You start off learning what is the field there. So they have their own way, through menial service. So it's the same thing. In the Gurukul, you're going to start with menial service. So even in the skill, they're going to start you off doing all the dirty jobs. But that develops the right attitude, the focus, the clarity, and everything like that. And because they'll work on such a strong pecking order, you know, then it will make you conscious, like, you know, the women are conscious. You know what I'm saying? Because they have that pecking order. So Shudras, it's a similar mentality. So they'll do the same thing. So then you have to, you know, do with the person there. So therefore your respect will come. By association, they'll teach you the knowledge, right? You have to do menial service. You started off with cleaning like that. And because of the nature of them, they have a dress they wear, and if you wear something different, they'll all laugh at you, so you have your outfit. So in one sense, if you see, they go through the same experience of that of the Gurukul. But just, it's on-the-job training. Like that. So they're, for when they finish, means, in other words, the boy goes to Gurukul when he graduates, he starts at 5 and he's out, you know, at 16, nowadays 18. You know, then he has the skill that he can go into anything and figure it out and make it work. Right? If it's something he's learned in the school, he directly applies it. If not, he'll figure it out. Right? The artist, you know, 5 o'clock, you know, I mean 5 years old, he's in that field of activities. By the time he's 16, 18, he's master in it. Right? So by the time, in other words, his father is taking care of the needs of the boys in the Gurukul's father. Right? But when he graduates, at the same time as graduating the people that he are his clientele. Understand? So he's a carpenter. When he graduates, now he can build the house of the person who just graduated. His father built the one of who's the father of the one that just graduated. Does that make sense? So it's a perfect system. Otherwise, you go through and then, you know, you never get out. Because artists are practical. At a young age, they can do. They don't have to wait till they're old. They can start. They may develop their own particular unique style, their own signature, their own, you know, flavor when they're older. You know what I'm saying? Just like if you see, you ever looked at that book, B.G. Sharma? Shows all his work, everything. So you see his older work is exact, it's really high grade of the exact traditions that he learned in. But you see at one point, it developed into something that was unique, that was his own. Other stuff before, it's the same as everybody else. Really good, but exactly the same. And at one point, it became his. But how old is he? You know? Like that. So that comes later, but the ability to do it right now is, you know what I'm saying? Because you only need one head mystery to give the inspiration. Everybody else has to do the work. So it comes automatically. Is that okay? It's a perfect system. Okay. Thus two heroes, dragging each other forward and pressing each other backward, and with sudden jerks, throwing each other face downward and sideways, mangled each other dreadfully. At times they struck each other with their knee joints, and addressing each other loudly in stinging speeches, they struck each other with clenched fists, the blows descending like a mass of stone upon each other. With broad shoulders and long arms, both well skilled in wrestling encounters, they struck each other with those long arms of theirs that were like maces of iron. That encounter of the heroes commenced on the first lunar day of the month of Kartik, and the illustrious heroes fought on without intermission and food, day and night, till the 13th lunar day. Right. So this is a Kalpa Veda from the Bhagavatam, right? Because the Bhagavatam they went for, I think, a month. Like that. You know, they'd stop each day, but here they went on 13 days straight, 24 hours. Didn't stop. No food, no drink. That's tough. It was on the night of the 14th of the lunar fortnight that the monarch of Magadha desisted from fatigue. And, O king, Janardhan, beholding the monarch tired, addressed Bhima of terrible deeds, and, as if to stimulate him, said, O son of Kunti, a foe that is fatigued cannot be pressed, for oppressed at such a time he might even die. Right? Yeah, I mean, a foe that is fatigued, you wouldn't want to, you know, do anything, because he might die in this process. Oh, yeah, you've got to be careful. Therefore, O son of Kunti, this king should not be oppressed by thee. On the other hand, O bull of the Bharata race, fight with him with thy arms, putting forth as much strength only as thy antagonist hath now left. Then that slayer of hostile foes, the son of Pandu, thus addressed by Krishna, understood the plight of Jarasandha, and forthwith resolved upon taking his life. Because right, up to that time, they were just having some good, clean fun. Right, you know? That foremost of all men, endued with strength, that prince of the Kuru race, desirous of vanquishing the hitherto unvanquished Jarasandha, mustered all his strength and courage. So we see that this works very nicely, because then by saying that, you can't say, oh, Krishna, he's the one that said it. Because he said it in the opposite, right? Because what you go by is not technically what's said, it's the mood. Right? Unless you hear it through third parties. But if you hear it directly, you go by the mood. Right? Because when you hear it through another party, then you can put your mood onto it and then, you know, turn them into whatever kind of monster you want them to be. Like that, and then, you know, it's, you know, fits their profile, so therefore you can not like them. Does that make sense? But if it's direct, it's the mood. Therefore Krishna's saying, oh no, hey, careful, you know, he's fatigued, you know, if you put too much strength, then how you say, you know, he might die. So therefore only wrestle with him how much he can handle. Right? Which means, you know, how much is needed to kill him. Right? But it sounds very pleasant, so then you get your job done at the same time as you don't create enemies based on simply, you know, what you're saying. So does that make sense? Section 24. Vaishampayana said, thus addressed, Bhima firmly resolved upon slaying Jarasandha. Replied unto Krishna, the Yadava race, saying, O tiger of the Yadu race, O Krishna, this wretch that yet stayeth before me with significant strength and bent upon fight should not be forgiven by me. Right? So now he's saying no, but, you know, because he's keeping, the other one is because, remember they were always making stinging words because it keeps the mood of the fight up. Right? Because they're kshatriyas, they like to fight, so you're going to win. It's going to be in a fighting mood. So even if he's going to destroy him, he has to still create the thing, because otherwise Jarasandha might think, oh, I'm weak, and now he can take advantage. But now he'll say something to keep the mood, right? One in himself, because if you think, oh, the other person's weak, you also drop. Does that make sense? Right? So then, so one has to be very, very careful of that. No? So he has to keep the mood up. Hearing these words of Rikodara, Bhima, that tiger among men, Krishna, desiring to encourage that hero to accomplish the death of Jarasandha without any delay, answered, O Bhima, exhibit today upon Jarasandha the strength thou hast luckily derived, the might thou hast obtained from thy father, the god Maruta. Right? So now you can't say, no, you're wrestling, so yes, you know, give it your best and stuff like that. No, I can complain. Thus addressed by Krishna, Bhima, that slayer of foes, holding up in the air the powerful Jarasandha, began to whirl him on high. Right? You know, kind of like the choirs. You know. O bull of the Bharata race, having so whirled him in the air full 100 times, Bhima pressed his knee against Jarasandha's backbone and broke his body in twain. And having killed him thus, the mighty Vrikardara uttered a terrible roar. The roar of the Pandava mingled with that death knell of Jarasandha while he was being broken on Bhima's knee, causing a loud uproar that struck fear into the heart of every creature. And all the citizens of Magadha became dumb with terror, and many women were even prematurely delivered. Hearing those roars, the people of Magadha thought that either the Himavat was tumbling down or the earth itself was being rent asunder. Those oppressors of all foes, then leaving the lifeless body of the king at the palace gate where he lay as one asleep, went out of the town. Krishna, causing Jarasandha's car furnished with an excellent flagstaff to be made ready and making the brothers Bhima and Arjuna ride in it, went in and released his imprisoned relatives. And those kings rescued from terrible fate, rich in the possession of jewels, approaching Krishna, made presentations unto him of jewels and gems. Having vanquished his foe, Krishna furnished with weapons, unwounded and accompanied by the kings he had released, came out of Giridvaja riding in that celestial car of Jarasandha. He also who could wield the bow with his hands, Arjuna, who is incapable of being vanquished by any of the monarchs on earth, who is exceedingly handsome in person, and well skilled in the destruction of the foe, accompanied by the possessor of great strength, Bhima, came out of that fort with Krishna driving the car thereon he rode, whereon he rode. That best of cars, incapable of being vanquished by any king, ridden in by those warriors Bhima and Arjuna, and driven by Krishna, looked exceedingly handsome. Indeed, it was upon that car that Indra and Vishnu had fought of old in the battle with the Asuras, in which Taraka, the wife of Vrishpati, had become the immediate cause of much slaughter. Riding upon that car, Krishna now came out of the hill fort. Possessed of the splendor of heated gold, and decked with rows of jingling bells, furnished with wheels whose clatter was like the roar of clouds, and ever victorious in battle, always slaughtering the foe against whom it was driven, it was that very car riding upon which Indra had slain 99 asuras of old. Right? Imagine bells on it, you know, so you got your, you know, M16 with a little nice line of bells on it, so it's jingling very pleasantly as you move it around. You know. Okay, so. Like that, or what is that? A Hummer, you know, with all little bells on the bottom. You know. Yeah. Like that. But why is it mentioned heated gold? Why that is a color? Yes, it's more bright. So gold is bright, but when it's heated, then it's even more dazzling, right? So that's so. Then the other was this chariot, because this was used by Vishnu. What is it? Vishnu and Indra. So it's a celestial chariot. So then, very, very special. And those bulls amongst men, the three cousins, having obtained that car, became exceedingly glad. The people of Magadha. Behold, the people of Magadha behold the long-armed Krishna? Beheld the long-armed Krishna, along with the two brothers, seated in that car of Jarasandha, wondered much. I think it would be, is it behold or would it be beholding? Yeah. Beheld or I think it could even be beholding. The people of Magadha beholding the long-armed Krishna, along with the two brothers, seated in that car of Jarasandha, wondered much, because it's basically the people of Magadha wondered much. Right. O Bharata, that car, whereunto were yoked celestial horses, and which possessed the speed of the wind, thus ridden upon by Krishna, looked exceedingly beautiful. Right. So this one moves at the speed of wind, right? So quite quick. But Krishna's chariot?
Mind,
yeah. Upon that best of cars with a flagstaff, without being visibly attached thereto, and which was the product of celestial skill. Right? You understand? It had a flagstaff on there, but it didn't look like it was connected to the cart. Right? So that was the celestial skill, how they could do those tricks, you know, because those are all the little something that, you know, it's like, you know, how you say, that little special thing, you know, like the, you know, how you say, you know, how you say, you know, the ivory handle on your 45 Magnum, you know, stuff like that, you know, little, you know, unique specialties, you know, like that. The handsome flagstaff possessed of the splendor of the rainbow could be seen from the distance of a yojana. Right? Yojana is how much?
8 miles.
8 miles, okay. So that means 12 kilometers. Krishna, while coming out, thought of Garuda, and Garuda thought of his master, came thither in no time, like a tree of vast proportions standing in a village, worshipped by all. Garuda, of immense weight of body and living upon snakes, sat upon that excellent car, along with the numberless open mouth and frightfully roaring creatures on its flagstaff. Right? So then, because the flagstaff comes up, and then there's a place that Garuda just sits on there. So he's roaring, and then all the other animals on the flag are also roaring, right? Like Arjuna's chariot had the same thing, right? So that adds to the ambience, right? It's like your chariot roars. You know, what about the warrior? And thereupon that best of cars became still more dazzling with its splendor, and was incapable of being looked at by created beings, as the midday sun surrounded by a thousand rays. O king, such was that best of flagstaffs of celestial make, that it never struck against any tree, nor could any weapon injure it at all, even though visible to men's eyes. And Achyuta, that tiger amongst men, riding with the two sons of Pandu upon that celestial car, the clatter of whose wheels was like the roar of the clouds, came out of Girivaja. That car upon which Krishna rode had been obtained by King Vasu from Vasava to Vriadraka, and from the latter in due course by King Jarasandha. He of long arms and eyes like lotus petals, and possessed of illustrious reputation, coming out of Girivraja, stopped for some time on the level plain outside the town. O king, all the citizens then, with the brahmanas at their head, hastened thither to adore him with due religious rites. And the kings who had been released from confinement worshipped the slayer of Madhu with reverence, and addressing him with eulogies said, O thou of long arms, thou hast today rescued us, sunk in the deep mire of sorrow in the hand of Jarasandha. Such an act of virtue by thee, O son of Devaki, assisted by the might of Bhima and Arjuna, is most extraordinary. Oh, we're over time. Okay, so then we see is that because you have to conclude, right? Now, the worship of Krishna, is that the conclusion of this fight with Jarasandha? Think about it. Or is that beginning something new? Huh? You understand? In other words, they come in as snatakas, you know, in a clever way and all that, and there's that mood of enmity. Then they have the fight, and then they go out as heroes. You understand? That concludes. Having done that, they ride out, then it's like, okay, here these guys came in, you know, like a needle, went out like a plow. Right? And so then they're great, they're heroic, that. So it's not just some guys came in and sneakily killed our king, but these are great heroes, very worshipable, very like this. So then, you know, no one feels bad if someone is killed by a superior, how you say? Yeah, by superior enemy, right? You feel bad if somebody superior was killed by some trick, you know, by someone inferior. No one really appreciates it. Even the bad guys don't like it. You know, right? So then there, that's done. Then he stops after he goes out. There's the plain, because around every city they have to have flat land. That's where all the cows graze, where all the farming goes on, and everything like that. So he stops there. Then all the people, now having seen all that, now can come and worship Krishna, the Supreme Lord, and offer their respects to Bhima and Arjuna. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the narration is slightly different. The way the Jara gets killed.
Yeah. It's
divided half.
Yes.
By the hint of Krishna dividing the three.
Yeah. Because this was because the Kalpabheda. It's a different time. So this wouldn't have been. This is not narrating the story of what happened just this last, the Sunday of the Dwapara Yuga, and this wasn't this last Dwapara Yuga. This would have been another one. Because every Dwapara Yuga, Krishna comes, and every time then the Pandavas are there and they have their pastimes. So then it's just a matter of, for the question that's asked, and for, you know, then the and who the audience is, then you tell the story. But the Bhagavatam then is different. It's not for a king who's acting as a king. It's not Janamejaya who is sitting there reigning. He's doing the snake sacrifice to, you know, revenge or avenge his father, you know, and the bad, and to set straight everything that Takshaka is not behaving properly. This is, you know, you're sitting with a king who's trying to go back to Godhead, and who's there is all saints and sages. So then you'll tell, you know, the different one. You know, then you'll tell the one connected to Krishna, you know, to Swayam Krishna, like that. Because then it's more, because the other one, it's like they fought for 13 days. And then at the end of that, you know, and it was just straight fight. And at the end, he just killed him, and then that was it. Very straightforward, much more simple, much more easy to digest. Right? But you see, if you use the Bhagavatam one, they would fight during the day, and as soon as the sun go down, they stop the fight, and then they'd all go sit together as friends and enjoy the evening food and, you know, music and dance and, you know, recreation that whatever Kshatriyas would do. And then, you know, refresh themselves and everything in the morning, be ready for the fight, and that way they fought for, you know, I think it was a month. Much more unsure, right? Much less intriguing in that way, because it's like you're dealing with better qualities here. It means not that they didn't have it here, but just manifesting it. Then you have the element thing that he was killed. Okay, he's killed. Yes, but then he comes back to life. And you can split him again. He'll come, join back together. Much more, the rasa is much more intense. More variety. And then, at the end, by cleverness, then he's put the other way, and then it works. So in other words, then you see, even here, cleverness is used by Krishna to make it work. So there, then, it's even more manifestation. So cleverness, in practical intelligence, is what actually makes things function. You know, academic intelligence that doesn't practically apply is not much use. And just straight emotion that doesn't have any connection to intelligence is also not greatly appreciated. The combination, that's what's nice. So it's shown in a more intense way. So that's the Bhagavatam. It's a higher shastra, so therefore the rasa tasted is even deeper. So even if it discusses the same pastime, the depth of the rasa will be greater. That's why it's a rasa shastra. While Mahabharata, dharma shastra. Like that. Does that make sense? So dharma gives you, that's where your taste is and the emotion. But rasa takes it even farther because of its proper connection to Krishna, and everything becomes more refined and everything. Because dharma is very powerful and it, but it's actually more simple. So here you're dealing in the rasa of what's happening, and so it becomes much more refined and much more complex. So technically, on this level, that pastime would not be appreciated, right? This is the perfect pastime to be explained for this situation. Well, the Bhagavatam, that's meant for the Rasiks, the Paramahamsas, so therefore that's the more perfect. Is that okay? Yeah? Okay.
Oh, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Shri Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jaya Nitya Gaura Premanandi.